Welcome to the fifth episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. In order to maintain the anonymity of the individuals concerned in these stories, names, places, and identifying features have been altered where appropriate. Therefore, any resemblance to individuals living or dead is purely coincidental. Although necessary details have been changed, these stories are based on actual events. They are real tragedies suffered by real people in real hospitals and clinics throughout England and Wales. When putting your life in the hands of another, it is natural to assume that that person is consistent in their work as much as they are infallible. To do otherwise is to question the proficiency of that individual and to believe that your life meanders carelessly in an unknown direction. Fortunately, it is often a symptom of danger that we are not always afforded the indulgence of doubt when starkly confronted in those immediate circumstances. So when a doctor, a fireman, or perhaps just a passerby happens to come so valiantly to our aid, our faith is absolute, and we are rarely distracted by the competency of that individual, so relieving ourselves of that added anxiety. It allows us to focus solely on the continuation of our living. It is a natural assumption to take, but not altogether correct. The behaviours of doctors are tempered by their training, and their decisions are led by evidence-based protocol, underlined by successions of stringent exams. It is a system that society has come to respect, but that doesn't mean that doctors don't act like humans. The minds of the best may still be corrupted by primitive instinct, those predicaments that inspire the unwavering rise of fear. For a competent doctor, most of their work is reassuringly mundane. Decisions are made with algorithmic certainty, allowing outcomes to be accepted regardless of their reception. But occasionally a doctor will be confronted by a case provoking inordinate and inexorable fear. It is then that their capabilities will surely be tested. Within any hospital, death quickly becomes commonplace, and for most, the routine soon makes it tolerable. But there are some things that the mind finds harder to accept. There is nothing I have seen to provoke fear as much as the prospect of a child in catastrophic danger. In the face of that event, the most junior doctors and medical students regress to a state of childlike uncertainty, entirely reliant on instructions from above them. The middle grade doctors will be able to retain a semblance of functionality, but their thinking will be clouded, and their hands will tremble at a task that not long ago they found entirely routine. The most senior doctor will perceptibly swell with necessary empowerment and drive their team forward with hard-earned experience and dogged determination. I have not yet met a person who can watch a child dying or a parent despairing and find anything about it tolerable or mundane. The events of this story involve the abuse of children, which will be particularly challenging for some listeners. Therefore, listener discretion is advised. It was Anna's fifth birthday when she happened to see her baby brother die. The morning before began like any other. She woke from her mattress and rubbed her eyes awake. It was cold in the room, but Anna rose eagerly and looked around for her brothers. They lay in two adjacent cots beneath the bedroom window, where the wintry light of day was just beginning to show. Nicholas was 16 months and Daniel was 2 months. They both lay swaddled in a colourful mass of blankets. Anna stared down at them and wished them both a good morning, before a voice hissed urgently at her not to wake her brothers. Anna turned around anxiously to see her mother awake, but the woman was smiling as she sat up in her bed. In the darkness of the bedroom, the flame from her lighter showed her where she lay, and Anna watched her sipping on the glow of a cigarette. Her mother was beckoning at Anna to join her in the big bed, but Anna was distracted by her brother's quiet murmuring. She sternly warned them both not to wake up the other before eagerly jumping into bed with her mother. It was warm in the big bed, blissfully warm. Anna felt her mother's chest sink lower into the bed as smoke billowed out away towards the ceiling. The peace was disrupted by her mother's hacking cough. She wiped her mouth dry before craning her neck to dab Anna with kisses. Then she straightened and announced that today was Anna's birthday. Anna spent her birthday watching television in the big bed and endlessly grazing on her favorite snacks. At the end of the day, Anna's mother laid her down on the mattress to sleep, with her two younger brothers gurgling in their cots. Later that night, Anna woke unexpectedly with the same confused fear that is brought by a nightmare. Several minutes passed by while Anna lay still in a fearful paralysis. She didn't know why she had woken this way. As far as she knew, her sleep had been dreamless. Instinctively, she sat up and watched the darkness around her, waiting for something to make itself seen. As her eyes adjusted, the blackness formed shapes, and she made out the figure of her mother breathing deeply, asleep in the big bed. The glow from the streetlights was dappled by snowfall that heaped on the pavement outside of Anna's window. She watched the silhouettes of her two brothers' cots. Anna wrapped her blanket tightly around her shoulders. Drawn up from her mattress, she moved unblinking towards her two brothers. A glance was all she needed to know that Nicholas was okay, but a similar glance told her that Daniel was not. Anna woke her mother, who immediately summoned help. It was not long before the street outside was filled with sirens and flashing lights, which spilled uninvited into Anna's cramped bedroom. The room was made busy with tall shouting strangers stomping around in their dark green uniforms. They left Anna's bedroom just as quickly as they had come, but Anna's youngest brother Daniel had been taken along with them. For the rest of the night, Anna slept in the big bed. Even little Nicholas had earned that privilege tonight. The two slept soundly either side of their mother, who stared wide-eyed at the ceiling above her. Anna's mother, Marta, found motherhood no easier than any other aspect of her worrisome life. She gave birth to Anna when she was just 17, and it didn't seem long before Nicholas and Daniel made them 4. Marta herself was born into a migratory family and subjected to abuse throughout the course of her childhood. At a young age, she was taken away from her parents and placed in the hands of an inadequate foster system in a country far away from the one she had been born in. By then, Marta was already a young adult, and there was no going back from the path she had chosen. The person she had become had nowhere to call home and no person to call family. She knew well how to make a child, but knew nothing of building a lasting family unit. This is how Marta found herself at 21 years of age, with 3 young children in need of her care. Even Anna's instincts could not save her brother. When the paramedics came, they found him not breathing, and so promptly commenced a futile resuscitation. Daniel died alone in the recessed department of accident and emergency, while the rest of his family slept together in their bed. The morning after Daniel had been taken, Anna found her mother in an unwilling mood. When Marta could not bear Anna's questions any longer, she exited the flat in thoughtless frustration. Several meals passed before she returned to her children. It was a pattern of behavior they would soon learn to get used to. Despite thorough investigation, no cause for Daniel's death was found by the doctors. In the absence of a known cause, his case was discussed with the hospital coroner, who deemed that a post-mortem would be the necessary next step. There are strict criteria determining when a post-mortem is necessary. Consent from the family is always sought, but when needs must, discussion with the family is nothing more than a courtesy. When the manner of a death remains unsolved, a post-mortem examination will happen regardless of the family's approval. Performed by an experienced pathology doctor, the investigation entails a systemic review of the bodily symptoms until a cause of death can reliably be found. No post-mortem should ever be performed lightly, but spontaneous deaths do not happen without cause. The reason for a death should always be questioned, not least in circumstances as tragic as Daniel's. The examination is performed in a number of steps. An incision is made down the front of the body to review the organs of the chest and the abdomen. A separate cut is then made at the back of the head to allow removal of the brain, which in turn is examined. Each bodily organ is carefully visualized, and small, select pieces of tissue may be removed for further analysis beneath the eye of a microscope. After careful examination, the organs are returned to their places in the body, and each of the various incisions are closed. Efforts are made to preserve the appearances of the deceased, but establishing the cause of death remains the priority. At the present time in the United Kingdom, funerals are predominantly closed casket affairs. Daniel's own funeral would not be a concern. The only people who came to mourn him were his mother and his siblings. He had no legal father to speak of. Throughout the small ceremony, Marta remained outwardly numb. Although Anna was only 5, she had already proved herself of being curious and insightful, but with no meaningful explanation, she remained entirely oblivious as to the whereabouts of her brother. For Marta's small family, life returned to normal the very same evening. In the days that followed, a new round of strangers came uninvited to Anna's room. This time, they came in a more delicate manner. They moved slowly around the bedroom, shielding themselves with their black leather clipboards, and talking in the gentlest, most reassuring voices. They asked Marta questions that Anna didn't understand. Anna wouldn't have minded their unannounced visit, but they took Daniel's cot, and she couldn't understand why he wouldn't still need it. The handling of Daniel's cot seemed to Anna to be a willful violation of her brother's sole possession. She cried and screamed, battling with the strangers to leave Daniel's cot alone. But Marta came across to lift her away, leaving them to take Daniel's cot freely, while Anna sobbed loudly into her mother's chest. Anna kept crying until she collapsed, exhausted into sleep on her mattress. The following days did not get any better for them. Unbeknownst to Anna, the post-mortem's conclusion found no cause of Daniel's death. In the context of his prematurity and below-average birth weight, the manner of his death was determined to be due to sudden infant death syndrome. Also known as cot death, sudden infant death syndrome describes the sudden and unexplained death of an infant. The manner of its process is poorly understood, but it is thought to be related to non-specific prior illness occurring in an infant who is inherently vulnerable. In England and Wales, approximately 270 deaths are attributed to sudden infant death syndrome every year. Fortunately, at present, these rates appear to be falling. In the aftermath of Daniel's death, Marta was visited by her doctor and representatives from the social services team. She was advised on ways she could create a safer environment for Anna and for Nicholas. It was carefully explained that the cot belonging to Daniel was poorly constructed and may have even played a role in his unexpected death. Nicholas's own cot was deemed to be similarly inadequate. Both were removed and ultimately destroyed. Marta listened carefully with dignified silence before reassuring those present that in the most tragic circumstances, she was coping quite well. Despite the presence of multiple health professionals, all experienced in the handling of health and safety in the home, their observations of Marta could not have been more wrong. But the meeting was concluded, and Marta was left alone with her remaining two children. Not 2 months later, Nicholas became unwell. Marta took him to the doctor, who observed that Nicholas was unusually irritable and concerned by Marta's description of his intermittent breathlessness. At 18 months, he should have been walking, but on this occasion he was unwilling to stand upright on his feet. The doctor examined him, listening carefully to his chest, before prescribing antibiotics for a suspected chest infection. The same doctor saw Nicholas only 5 days later, and he was pleased to see that his condition had dramatically improved. Nicholas was more settled and playing with his toys, but he was still unwilling to stand up on his feet. With his course of antibiotics completed, Nicholas was sent home with no further follow-up. 3 days following this consultation with the doctor, Marta was speaking to an emergency operator, calmly explaining that her child was not breathing. It was the early hours of morning, but an ambulance was summoned and dispatched as a priority. Not long later, Marta was sitting patiently in an accident and emergency cubicle with an agitated Anna sat to her side. On the table before her, her youngest child, Nicholas, cried inconsolably while a pediatric doctor meticulously examined him. The doctor was coming to the end of a night shift, but the arrival of Nicholas had sharpened her attention. A grieving mother reporting prolonged episodes where her child would stop breathing. Nicholas cried throughout the examination and whimpered where he lay, but from the doctor's perspective, his breathing appeared normal. Various explanations circulated wearily through the doctor's mind. The only abnormality was the child's obvious irritability, but what child isn't when kept awake through the night? An over-anxious mother is a simple enough concept, especially in the context of a younger child's recent death. And yet Marta did not appear as a typically anxious mother. She yawned out of boredom and made irrelevant complaints to whoever would listen. From the doctor's perspective, the older child with her seemed considerably more concerned compared to the mother who seemed to be pushing for a discharge. The pediatric doctor was not yet prepared to send the child home. She called her consultant, sensing there was something that she wasn't yet seeing. By the time the consultant came, Nicholas was more settled, although not as much as Marta, who was dozing on her seat. After completing her review, the consultant was reassured by Nicholas's appearance and generally unconcerned by the indifference of his mother. But the consultant saw one thing that her junior had missed. There was a subtle line of bruising along the side of Nicholas's chest. They subsequently arranged for an X-ray of his chest with ongoing monitoring of Nicholas's condition in the meantime. Not far away, a radiology doctor was also coming to the end of a night shift. In a dimly lit reporting room, the radiologist trawled through the overnight X-rays. He saw and reported on broken bones, pneumonias, and cancerous lesions, in addition to the many unremarkable studies. But then he saw one that caused him to sit up stiffly in his chair. The skeletal projection had materialized on his monitor. The skeleton he scrutinized was unquestionably childlike, with unfused extremities signifying bones that are still growing. But there was something else that gave him a surge of adrenaline. The anatomy was distorted. The child's heart should have been positioned in the center of the image, but instead it was displaced far to the left side of the chest. The right lung too had been pulled out of position and was similarly displaced over to the left side. As the radiologist looked closer, he noticed several ribs that had been broken on the right. When a broken rib pierces through the membrane that encases the lungs, inhaled air is sucked into the space that surrounds the lung on that side. As the patient breathes out, air inside the lungs is exhaled through the mouth, but the air that has leaked into the tissue around the pierced lung becomes trapped where it is, with no place to escape. Each subsequent breath only makes the problem worse. Each subsequent breath sucks more and more air into the space around the affected lung, squeezing the pierced lung to the opposite side. The pressure builds up until it is strong enough to separate the lung from the adjacent chest wall. If allowed to continue, the heart is affected next. Like the displaced lung, the heart is shifted over to the opposite side. The vessels returning blood to the displaced heart become stretched and collapsed until the venous blood ceases to flow. Death follows swiftly if the pressurized chest is not quickly decompressed. The reporting radiologist did not waste a moment writing a report. He picked up a phone and called the emergency doctors. When the call was not answered, he threw down the phone and ran to them instead. Nicholas's breathing had worsened. By now, his blood was poorly oxygenated, and he was becoming exhausted from the ongoing pain and effort of breathing. The deterioration had been rapid, but the intended medical monitoring had not been enacted while his mother had been sleeping with headphones on her ears. Only Anna was present. She stood by her brother on her tallest tiptoes to hold his hand gently and console his little cries. A pale-faced radiologist frantically entered the busy department. He searched for the doctor who was looking after Nicholas. She responded immediately to find Nicholas in his cubicle. Anna backed off to wake up her mother. The doctor spent seconds listening to Nicholas's chest through the tubes of her stethoscope. That was all she needed to know what to do. She stuck her head out the cubicle and called out indiscriminately for anyone to come and help her. Already she knew that time was running out. She threw off Nicholas's blanket and drew imaginary lines across the right side of his chest. With her left hand, she fingered the gaps between his ribs. With her right hand, she held a needle, poised carefully in an upright position. Nicholas's chest jutted with each weakening breath. The doctor took aim and pushed the needle down slowly. It stuck in Nicholas's rib and would not go down any further. Nicholas winced, and his mouth opened weakly in a noiseless scream. She withdrew the needle and adjusted its angle. She punched it down firmly, and Nicholas made a grunt. The needle had found its mark, sliding between ribs to connect with the air that had displaced Nicholas's right lung. It made an audible hiss as the air rushed through the needle, and the pressurized air was quickly decompressed. The emergency doctor closed her eyes gratefully before realizing the room was now busy with people. The emergency crash team had arrived, and she was now supported by a specialized team. Nicholas was soon stabilized, but his troubles were not done. The x-rays of his chest showed numerous fractures of his ribs on both sides. Some were displaced, piercing through the lungs, and evidently were a cause for his respiratory distress. But there were other fractures present, with evidence of bony remodeling and callus formation. Both were features of fractures that had had time to heal. Nicholas's injuries had been inflicted over a period of time. Further x-rays were obtained. The conclusions drawn told an even more troubling story. As well as the rib fractures, further breaks were seen in the bones of all four of his limbs. When the doctors confronted Marta with Nicholas's x-ray findings, she confidently gave her own observations. She explained to the doctors that after the death of her youngest child, she had taught herself the basics of cardiopulmonary resuscitation. When she saw that Nicholas had stopped breathing, she immediately responded with compressions to his chest. This, she explained, was the reason for his fractures. The attending doctor hesitated briefly at this plausible explanation before asking why Nicholas should have so many other injuries. Some of the fractures were new and displaced, whereas others were calloused, evidencing fractures inflicted months before. Marta paused momentarily before her resolve broke. Her defiance dissolved and she exploded into tears, apparently outraged at the accusatory tone. The hospital safeguarding team were quickly consulted, and they in turn informed the police. With mounting suspicion building against her, Marta was arrested, while Anna was placed into an emergency shelter with the investigation ongoing. Nicholas's condition in hospital became increasingly precarious. He was admitted onto the intensive care unit, where his heart and lungs required continuous support. Despite the best medical care, he sank deeper and deeper into a comatose state. An MRI scan was performed. It showed evidence that his brain had already started dying. After relentless 2 weeks of escalating support, a decision was made to discontinue his life support. Nicholas died shortly after, at just 18 months of age. Police and social services were quick to investigate, but no one could have predicted how disturbing it would become. Marta was a sex worker, tirelessly meeting men to supplement her income. But this wasn't just a job, indeed often it was not. To Marta, this was a lifestyle that brought addictive attention and insatiable pleasure. When taken to court, the full extent of her lifestyle was laid before the jury. Marta had been known to brag on social media about the earnings she had made from her sex work. This only helped to expose the extent of her dysfunctional addiction. Even when taking her children to hospital, there was evidence that she sent indecent images to clients and to friends from the hospital bathroom, just a few meters from her struggling child and the doctor who attended to him. During that same admission, she even exchanged numbers with a member of the hospital security, with whom she'd later have sexual relations. All the while, her child was struggling to breathe. No one could know what personal afflictions Marta must have suffered throughout her life that brought her to this place where she must sell her body just to make ends meet. But it was the evidence revealed on her internet search history that made her crimes utterly unforgivable. Pages and pages of evidence revealed her internet search history, which blatantly sought out ways that she could kill her children. Specifically, there were searches on how long it takes to drown, as well as other ways she might asphyxiate her children. The ambulance paramedics who first came for Daniel reported that the child was already freezing to the touch and evidently lifeless by the time they had reached him. Marta would have been able to contact them far earlier had she wanted to, but it was clear that her intention was to be certain that there was no possibility that her child could be saved. There was a point in Marta's life when it became clear to her that her children were obstructing the lifestyle that she wanted and the attention that she craved. And when that point came, she meticulously set about planning the murder of her children. In the case of Nicholas, he would have suffered terribly before eventually dying. The x-rays obtained of his chest, abdomen, and limbs showed numerous fractures, tragically demonstrating his tortured life. Her 16-month-old boy seemed to Marta to be nothing more than a toy on which she could vent her own pains and frustrations. Marta's monstrous actions would eventually be rewarded with a lifetime in prison. That Marta succeeded is an unequivocal tragedy. That Anna survived is a hopeful blessing. Anna's future reflects the path her own mother took as a child entering the foster care system. But at only 5 years of age, Anna has already demonstrated a resourceful intelligence and an instinct for survival. Only time will tell how her life will unfold, but my hope and my belief is that little Anna will grow stronger from the experiences she has suffered, and she will live out a life that is considerably brighter than the one into which she was born. These stories deal with themes that will be challenging for some. If you're in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything.